In Arensky's Fantasia on Russian Folk Songs, we heard Konstantin Shcherbakov as the soloist with the Russian Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Dmitry Yablonsky. You can find information about all the music we've featured this week by going to the Radio 3 homepage and following the links. Join me again next week for another Composer of the Week.
Composer of the Week was presented this week by Donald MacLeod with studio guest Gerard McBurney. This week's series was produced in Cardiff by Luke Whitlock. And next week, Donald's focus falls on Brahms. That's at 12 midday on Monday, with another chance to hear the programme at 6:30 on Monday evening. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's a minute after 7 o'clock now, and time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of this evening's proms. It's presented by Katie Derham.
Yes, and good evening to you, and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall, where the BBC Concert Orchestra is going to whisk us away to the movies this evening for a celebration of the finest music written for film. Under the enthusiastic baton of the Concert Orchestra's chief conductor, the charismatic Boston Pops Supremo Keith Lockhart, we've music by Walton, Morricone, John Williams, of course, and the late, great John Barry. We've a world premiere by Radiohead's Johnny Greenwood, and the orchestra will be joined during the evening by violinist Chloe Hanslip and Shakespearean actor Rory Kinnear. But we're getting off to a suitably dramatic start with three pieces by Hitchcock's favourite composer, Bernard Herrmann, who'd have been 100 this year. In fact, the very first score he wrote was for a little film called Citizen Kane. As he said later, "I was fortunate to start my career with a film like Citizen Kane. It's been downhill ever since." Well, you can hear the applause there for the leader of the BBC Concert Orchestra, Cynthia Fleming. We're going to be hearing the overture to Citizen Kane in a moment, followed by the Psycho Suite, but first we'll be hearing the prelude to Hitchcock's Man Who Knew Too Much. Making his way to the stage now, the Concert Orchestra's chief conductor, Keith Lockhart.
Thank you.
Overture to Citizen Kane there. And before that, we heard Bernard Herrmann's prelude to The Man Who Knew Too Much. But now it's just time to check behind the shower curtain.
Thank you.
6,000 people here in the Royal Albert Hall on edge and visibly jumping during Bernard Herrmann's Psycho Suite there. Before then, we heard his overture to Citizen Kane, and before that, the prelude to The Man Who Knew Too Much. Three pieces by Bernard Herrmann, who the London Symphony Orchestra called The Man Who Knows
So Much. Wow, what a happy way to start an evening. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the proms. In the program this evening, we're going to be playing some of our favorite music from the sound stages of Hollywood and of Great Britain. Music that has been amusing, frightening, thrilling, and inspiring audiences for almost three quarters of a century now. We started with Bernard Herrmann, whose music is inextricably linked with the work of British film director Alfred Hitchcock, and who made a very famous appearance as a conductor on this very stage in the 1955 film The Man Who Knew Too Much. We have replicated that moment for you, save having the body actually fall out of the balcony. During the rest of tonight's program, we will pay tribute to living legend Sir Richard Rodney Bennett on the occasion of his 75th birthday, John Williams, who will turn 80 next year, also paying tribute to the recently passed John Barry, and looking forward to the future with music from David Arnold and from Johnny Greenwood. But for now, please, to play a very, very beautiful rendition of the tender love theme from Cinema Paradiso, please welcome outstanding young British violinist Chloe Hanslip.
Chloe Hanslip there playing the theme from Cinema Paradiso by Ennio Morricone with the BBC Concert Orchestra conducted by Keith Lockhart, who you heard introducing that piece. Cinema Paradiso, the Oscar-winning tale of the friendship between a young boy and the elderly film projectionist at the cinema in his Sicilian village. It was scored by Morricone, one of the 500 film scores that he's written over his long life. In fact, one year, he managed to write 26. That's one a fortnight. Of course, you'll be able to hear more of his work celebrated in a very particular way by the Spaghetti Western Orchestra in tonight's late night prom at 10 o'clock. Wonderful response here in the Royal Albert Hall to Chloe Hanslip, who's only 23, but actually made her prom's debut back in 2002. She's been a regular on concert platforms since she was 11, a real child prodigy, record-breakingly young recording artist, and re-emerged into superstar status in 2005 with a recording of John Adams' violin concerto, which had the critics absolutely reeling. Name a prize, she's probably won it, and although we are hearing her play very familiar tunes tonight, she'll be back a little later with the theme from Schindler's List. Now next, we have some music by William Walton. He'd written 9 film scores by the time he and Laurence Olivier collaborated on Henry V. He composed it between 1943 and 1944. It was a huge success and earned him an Oscar nomination. 29 years later, he authorised British conductor Muir Mathieson, one of his closest musical friends and colleagues, to create a suite from the film music, and that is what we're going to hear now, with excerpts of Shakespeare, chosen by Keith Lockhart, narrated by rising Shakespearean star Rory Kinnear. The suite is in 5 movements. Briefly, they are the overture, which accompanies the film's opening aerial view of London, and then a passaglia, the charge and battle, the Agincourt song, and we have Touch Her Soft Lips and Part in the middle. But the cheers and claps you're hearing now are from Rory Kinnear and Charles Lockhart to perform Walton's Henry V suite.
Of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. A kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. Then should the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars, and at his heels, leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword and fire crouch for employment. But pardon, gentles all, the flat, unraised spirits that have dared on this unworthy scaffold to bring forth so great an object. Can this cockpit hold the vasty fields of France? Or may we cram within this wooden O, the very casks that did affright the air at Agincourt. Let us, on your imaginary forces, work. Suppose within the girdle of these walls are now confined 2 mighty monarchies, whose high, upreared and abutting fronts the perilous narrow ocean parts asunder. Piece out our imperfections with your thoughts. into 1,000 parts, divide one man, and make imaginary puissance. Think, when we talk of horses, that you see them printing their proud hoofs to the receiving earth, for 'tis your thoughts that now must deck our kings, carry them here and there, jumping o'er times, turning the accomplishment of many years into an hourglass. For the which supply, admit me, chorus to this history, who, prologue-like, your humble patience pray, gently to hear, kindly to judge, our play. Falstaff, he is dead. The king hath killed his heart. God save thy grace, King Hal, my royal Hal. God save thee, my sweet boy, my king, my Jove. I speak to thee, my royal heart. I know thee not, old man. Fall to thy prayers. How ill white hairs become a fool and a jester. I have long dreamt of such a kind of man, so surfeit swelled, so old and so profane. But being awaked, I do despise my dream. Reply not to me with a full-born jest. Presume not that I am the thing I was. For God doth know, so shall the world perceive, that I have turned away my former self. So shall I those who kept me company. Once more unto the breach, dear friends, once more. Or close the wall up with our English dead. In peace, there's nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness and humility. But when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger. Stiffen the sinews. Conjure up the blood. Disguise fair nature with hard-favored rage. Then lend the eye a terrible aspect. Let it pry through the portage of the head like a brass cannon. Now set the teeth and stretch the nostril wide. Hold hard the breath and bend up every spirit to his full height. On, you noblest English, whose blood is fet from fathers of war-proof. Fathers that, like so many Alexanders, have in these fields from morn till even fought and sheathed their swords for lack of argument. Dishonor not your mothers. Now attest that those whom you called fathers did beget you. Be copy now to men of grosser blood and teach them how to war. And you, good yeoman, whose limbs were made in England, show us here the mettle of your pasture. Let us swear that you are worth your breeding, which I doubt not. For there is none of you so base and mean that hath not noble luster in your eyes. I see you stand like greyhounds in the slip, straining upon the start. The game's afoot. Follow your spirit. And upon this charge, cry God for Harry, England, and St. George!
Thank you.
Farewell. Farewell, divine Xenocrate. Is it not passing brave to be a king and ride in triumph through Persepolis? Touch her soft lips and part. Proclaim it, Westmoreland, through my host, that he which hath no stomach to this fight, let him depart. His passport shall be made, and crowns for convoy put into his purse. We would not die in that man's company that fears his fellowship to die with us. This day, it's called the Feast of Crispian. He that outlives this day and comes safe home shall stand a tiptoe when this day is named and rouse himself at the name of Crispian. He that shall see this day and live old age shall yearly on the vigil feast his neighbors and say, tomorrow is Saint Crispian. Then will he strip his sleeve and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispin's day. Old men forget, but all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. And then shall our names, familiar in his mouth as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man tell his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day till the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap whiles any speaks that fought with us upon Saint Crispin's day.
Thank you.
rousing performance there of Walton's music from Henry V, the suite arranged by Muir Mathieson. It's stirring narration from award-winning actor Rory Kinnear. The BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Keith Lockhart. An extremely popular performance of that suite here in the Royal Albert Hall. The suite comprised five movements. We heard the overture at the Globe Playhouse, then the Passacaglia, the Death of Falstaff, the Charge and Battle. And you may have recognised at the end of the Charge and Battle, the Bayero. It's a traditional French tune, but very familiar to lovers of Cantilupe songs of the Auvergne. And then we heard the wonderfully lyrical Touch Her Soft Lips and Part. And then another stirring number at the end, the Agincourt song. The whole piece was written after Walton had seen the film Alexander Nevsky, the great Prokofiev-Eisenstein collaboration. And indeed, you may well have heard the great cantata arrangement of that piece a couple of weeks ago here, performed by the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andres Nelson. And I have to say, it was a thrilling night then. Lots more to come, but now it is the interval, and it's time to join Matthew Sweet for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Hello and welcome to tonight's Proms literary event. We're here again at the Royal College of Music, the building that loiters on the pavement behind the Royal Albert Hall, for another exploration of some of the ideas behind the scores of this year's Proms programme. Tonight's concert is full of ideas, some of them involving slashing Janet Leigh to death in a shower, galloping over the hills with Laurence Olivier, or dive-bombing Cary Grant with a crop sprayer. My two guests tonight have just walked up onto the stage here, but don't let me stop you picturing something much more dangerous. They are the playwright and Oscar-winning screenwriter Ronald Harwood, whose scripts have yielded The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, Private Potter and The Pianist. And with him is a man also known as The Pianist, Neil Brand, one of the world's foremost silent film composers and a screenwriter in his own right. Welcome them as dramatically as you can. Thank you. That's terrific. But would we have believed it more if there were some stirring strings underneath it, I wonder? Ronald, psychologists have proved that the music that we hear accompanying an image has a profound effect on how we read that image. Does that delight you or dismay you?
Oh, no, it delights me, because I don't know if you've ever watched a film without any music. I mean, I get to sometimes to watch the rough cut without any soundtrack at all, except the dialogue. And you know something's missing, and you don't know what. And then you watch the next version with the score, and it's a different movie. Movies are a collaborative effort, and no one part is more important than another. But music is an essential part to give the film a kind of continuity. That's what it does. It makes it coherent.
Does it have too much power sometimes? Is there sometimes a struggle between the image and the music?
If it's bad, it does. Or if you come out saying, God, wasn't the music lovely? Then something's wrong. Or if you come out saying the camera work was wonderful, that's another terrible thing. Or wasn't it well directed? It should just immerse you as a totality. And if it does, then everything has come together. And that's a marvellous thing. If you can manage it, you can't always manage it.
Neil, what's your take on all this? Sometimes the music can really tell us exactly what we should be thinking about an image that's presented to in a film.
Well, it's worth bearing in mind always that film music is a collaborative art. You can't work as a film composer in isolation. You're working to somebody else's brief almost continuously. Someone like Bernard Herrmann actually did have it written into his contract that he should not be told what to write. So he could write what he wanted as he wanted to. But even there, I can't believe for a moment that he was left entirely to his own devices, that a director working with him wouldn't have said, can you see, we need something here. And I think the beauty of film music is where they're still able to produce great music that is timeless, even though it's been done for a specific job and usually to a specific length and with a specific brief in mind.
John Barry said a wonderful thing about, with whom I worked, incidentally. He said, the composer has to keep his ego out of it. And I think that's right. Once the composer says, look, this is by John Barry or by Korngold or whoever, there's a problem. And it has to, as Neil says, be part of the entirety.
You can understand why directors work with the same composers again and again and again, because actually got to be a mind meld there. Yeah. They've got to be able to understand exactly what the other one's going to require.
But Neil, when you play a silent film, when you accompany a silent film, does any of that power devolve to you? I mean, how much are you responsible for shaping what's going on in audiences' head? Maybe you could
illustrate rather beautifully. Yes, the beauty of playing for silent films is the director's dead, so there's nobody to tell you what to play. But of course, what you're trying to do is take from the film what the music is required. Yes, I mean the music is actually giving a sense to the audience of something they can live in, and it has to try and hopefully match what they're feeling about the film. But to take a particular instance, the film South, which is a documentary about Shackleton's disastrous expedition to the South Pole in 1915, there was film taken of that, and some of the film shows the ship of which he took to get to the Antarctic slipping beneath the ice, and 30 men stranded on that ice. They got back through the most extraordinary set of circumstances, phenomenal tale of courage. But that footage you could play in three ways at least. First, just the pure impressionism of white with this dark ship against it falling apart, which would just... which gives you no sense of what is going to come out of this. It's only the moment itself. So, okay, two takes on what we could be feeling about the people involved. The loss, for instance, as a thought. That is pure grief and loss and a sense that they're not going to come back. We know they did. So the extra thing I can put into the music is actually a sense of the strength of those men, which is now going to be tested to the utmost. The basic difference between those is actually just key, major and minor key. There was minor throughout all of that, but it resolved to major. It's as simple as that, and that's at the heart of a lot of what Herman does as well.
Thank you very much, Neil. Thank you. Now, Ronald, Neil is taking us back to a time there when the composer was really, in a way, playing some of the parts that the writer now plays in the film, having to kind of indicate, in essence, the mood, what some of the dialogue might even be.
I don't know what you mean. No one replaces the screenwriter, no one. What music does is enhances the mood or the action. And that's very, where it comes is one of the crucial decisions in making the final version of the film between the director and the composer. Well, I think they call it spotting, don't they? When they spot where the music should come. And that's crucial. And then they have a discussion, which I've been present at. I've had no part, they don't listen to the screenwriter, of course. But they do say things like, I think I want it to be passionate, or it should be very calm, or it should be contrary to the image. And then they go away and they write their music and bring it back. And then, of course, the composer has real problems with the length of the shot. So that if he has a tune, it has to fit maybe a minute, 10 seconds. And that, I think, is a terrific, t- technical achievement when they do that.
And do you sit out of these discussions because...
No, because they take no notice of me. No, no, for no, no, no.
But
for
when
no
you're
other
sitting
reason.
Down and writing a script, do you give any thought to to what the audience might be hearing?
No, I think you write the film as you simply from a storytelling point of view, and then. And that you have to keep in your mind, how best to tell the story. Then it has to be realized with the director, the actors, and the musician, the composer.
So have you ever felt that the music on a furnished film of yours has been at odds with what you've been trying to
do? I felt there's been too much sometimes. I won't go into specific detail, but sometimes I feel there's one cut too many, where one cue too many where there's music was not necessary. But it's a question of judgment and taste at the time you're doing the editing.
Neil, the first 30 years of cinema, music had a rather more powerful place, doesn't it, than in the world of cinema today?
Well, yes. I mean, during the silent period, music was all there was. I don't know if you've come across this story recently, that a whole load of silent movie music has turned up in Birmingham, at Birmingham Library, over 4,000 pieces. And it's specific mood music, but very specific. I mean, one of the pieces is actually called Desert Monotony. So that's for when a desert scene crops up in your film, there's some music for it. But then when you go into the beginnings of sound, there is still this sense that the composer and the music are there almost constantly. I mean, it's particularly when you're with the mid-30s. There's a sense that the music is carrying the film with a continuity to it, and I'm sure that's very much of its period.
Can I just ask a question? When you see it and you decide where you're going to play, do you ever think, well, I won't play for this sequence and have silence there?
I can't go to complete silence for a very, very long time because I think there's a judgment call about that.
Yeah.
If you do that with a silent film, all you have is silence, and that silence becomes filled with the sound of people in the auditorium.
Yes.
And if you do it, yes, with a mate with a film, yeah. And I can see particularly your point about too much music, because there's also an element that too much music in a film sometimes suggests that they're not entirely trusting that the film is going to make its point without the music telling us what to think. And in fact, a lot of people watching something like a Korngold picture, you take something like Robin Hood, the music's almost continuous through Robin Hood, but it's also worth bearing in mind that it's an adventure film in which the music has to put us into medieval England, and this is a 30s Hollywood audience has to go to medieval England. It also is a ballet, and it's an opera, and that Korngold wrote opera, and that what we have there is an amazing achievement by him to not just give us a sense of the world of England in the Robin Hood's time, but Errol Flynn himself is in that music. Bum, 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 ba, bum, 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 ba, bum, bum, ba, 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 bum, bum, bum. That's him jumping through Sherwood Forest in a way that is far more believable than if we'd seen Errol Flynn himself jumping through Sherwood Forest.
There's a danger, isn't there, certainly in the earlier films in the 30s and 40s, of pastiche music that you get. I remember, this was after the war, I went to Shepperton, I think, and Miklos Roscher, who was a Hungarian composer of note, did the music for Ivanhoe with Robert Taylor and Elizabeth Taylor. And it was medieval England, that's what reminded me, but it was sort of pastiche. You didn't think it was from him, it didn't seem to come out of him at all. It seemed to just be what he thought medieval music would sound like.
There are some directors who reject the use of music entirely, aren't there? See, is it a sort of impurity?
Absolutely. I think they did on the Orient Express, didn't they? I think they got rid of the first composer and then got Richard Rodney Bennett. I don't know who the first composer was. Is that not right?
I'm not sure.
Am I maligning somebody? Probably. We'll probably all be sued now.
But yes, they do. There have been soundtracks, entire soundtracks, junked.
More famously, William Walton, which is a well-known story on Battle of Britain.
Yes. But there are some directors who see music of any kind as an unwelcome incursion, aren't there?
I've not worked with one. I don't know. Probably there are. Megalomaniacs, probably. Yes.
What's the status of film music? I mean, is it a sort of a fragment of a more complete whole, or is it something that has an existence unto itself?
There's multiple statuses, aren't there? You have to bear in mind that film music is most people's, particularly most young people's, regular dose of classical music these days. So its status is actually huge. people aren't going to the cinema to go, I want to hear great music. But I think it's a responsibility on film composers to write great music for that reason. But the actual status of the film composer is very, very small, because he's almost always the last person onto the production. The production has been going for many, many months beforehand. Not always. In some cases, a composer has been brought in very early in order to be part of the production. But usually, it's what they call the last cab off the rank. And he's got to produce a tremendous amount of music in probably no more than 2 months, if that.
And there's terrible snobbery, awful snobbery about film composers. But, you know, any popular medium immediately produces a snobbish response. The worst thing in the world is to be a popular writer or composer, because you're going to come in for stick from the critics who are longing to be popular critics. And and they're not. But I think Eric Korngold said the ultimate thing about it, he said, music is music. And I believe that to be true.
So who are the great film composers then? Who God, should we be canonising?
Prokofiev, Walton, Vaughan Williams' wonderful Antarctica suite. I don't, it's called, what is it?
Symphonia Antarctica, as yes. It became. But yes, he wrote it for...
Oh, there's some marvel. And James Horner now, I think, is a wonderful composer. There are many, many of them, and they're top-notch, and I'm proud to work with any of them. And the snobbery, absolutely, I find reprehensible.
You're mentioning Richard Rodney Burnett. He is one of Britain's greatest composers, whether it's for film or for anything else. But I think he's looked on as less great because he works with film and he works with jazz.
Yes.
And I think that's an absolute tragedy, because what he should be recognised is one of our greatest living composers, full stop. And the fact that he wrote some of that music for film is neither here nor there.
Tonight's concert features some of the music of Bernard Herrmann, who I know is a favourite of yours, Neil, and who you could maybe kind of deconstruct for us and tell us, you know, where does the source of his genius lie?
Yeah, I'll nail my colours to the mast. Bernard Herrmann was the greatest avant-garde composer of the 20th century, as far as I'm concerned. He had more genuine experimentalism within working for film than most other composers could hope to do just working for the concert hall. One of the keys into Bernard Herrmann always is, curiously, the most obvious one. It's that very small idea which is incredibly potent, like this one, for instance. When you ally that to Saul Bass's visuals at the beginnings of Vertigo, and you have those spinning senses there, you don't need anything else. He brings that motif back in throughout the whole film. But when he develops it into both a piece of suspense and a piece of romance. At the beginning of the titles of Vertigo, we're taken, as an audience, up the side of a high building. You actually hear the music going... And then it goes to this. Four chords. Unresolved, mysterious, dark, tense. Beautiful, warm, resolved chord which suggests romance, which suggests there's something warm there. And I think this is where he scores over almost anybody else. The very first film score that he did, which was Citizen Kane, which he did for Orson Welles, there you have the main theme of Citizen Kane in the first 10 seconds of the music, but you're not going to know it's there. It's literally four notes. It's just that. Citizen Kane starts, if you remember, with a climb up a fence, and you see at the top, no trespasses. And underneath that, you have these fat, low chords. And then you get... On the vibraphone, so it's ringing, there's this kind of lovely feel to it. At the very end of the film, when we found out what Rosebud is and what we've been looking for the whole time, that comes out as...
It's this sense of a finish and of a continuity. I think that's the great thing that Bernard Herrmann taught all film composers, is you don't have to think huge, you actually have to think as small and as direct as possible, and then build out from there.
Thank you very much, Neil. Thank you. And this, I think, is where we came in. But before the cartoons come round again, let's show our appreciation for Neil Brand and Sir Ronald Harwood. Thank you very much.
Matthew Sweet presented this evening's Proms Plus Literary event, and the producer was Gavin Hurd. But welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's extravaganza of film music. We're going to launch into the second half with music by a composer whose attachment to a film project almost guarantees box office and critical success, John Williams. He's won 5 Oscars, but he's been nominated 45 times. I think he's the most nominated person alive, and there's no sign of the work drying up. It's hard to choose from his massive body of work. You'd know them all. But we're going to start with Star Wars, and then we'll hear the heartbreaking main theme from Schindler's List, and then Hedwig's theme from Harry Potter. Goodness me, though, we could have had Superman, Jaws, E.T., the Indiana Jones films. The list goes on and on. His range is huge. He's fundamentally a romantic traditionalist, but he's very happy to use new techniques and pop music. His relationship with Steven Spielberg, he's scored all but one of his films. He says it's like a marriage, over nearly 40 years long now. But he says he takes nothing for granted as, I quote, there are a lot of film composers in the world. Apparently, when John Williams saw Schindler's List for the first time, he was so moved I could barely speak. He said, Stephen, you need a better composer than I am to do this film. But here comes Keith Lockhart to conduct the BBC Concert Orchestra in a selection of music by John Williams.
Thank you.
exotic galaxy far, far away, that famous theme from Star Wars by John Williams.
There's not much need to introduce that piece, the main title from the movie Star Wars, by John Williams, perhaps the best known of living composers, and the person who has been nominated for more Academy Awards than any other living person. I have had the honor of being John Williams' successor as conductor of the Boston Pops, so I've gotten to know him over these last 17 years, and he's an amazingly modest man, given his accomplishments. But what really amazes me about John is the chameleon-like way in which he adapts and inhabits the soul of the movies he's writing for. It's hard to imagine the range of his 80-some films, from adventure movies like Raiders of the Lost Ark and Harry Potter, to incredibly evocative atmosphere pieces like Memoirs of a Geisha, to the intense and beautiful score to Schindler's List. And to do the main title from that amazing movie, originally written for Itzhak Perlman, please welcome back Chloe Hanslip.
The main theme to Schindler's List, performed by Chloe Hanslip with the BBC Concert Orchestra conducted by Keith Lockhart. One of John Williams' most beautiful themes, I think. Keith Lockhart bringing the whole orchestra to their feet, with particular thanks to the Corps Anglais. He duetted so wonderfully with Chloe there. But now we're entering a whole new sound world. Welcome to Harry Potter.
Thank you.
Hedwig's theme from Harry Potter by John Williams, bringing to an end the sequence of John Williams tunes at tonight's special film music prom. Keith Lockhart bringing the BBC Concert Orchestra to their feet to take the applause from the crowd. Special mention should go to Celeste player Jim Osborne, who opened that piece so beautifully. John Williams, what a hero to fans of film music. Of course, he's written for so many works for film, and as we heard, not just a composer, but a great conductor too, the predecessor to Keith Lockhart at the Boston Pops. And those of you wondering what he's working on now, well, I can reassure you there is another Steven Spielberg collaboration in the pipeline. In fact, The Adventures of Tintin, Secret of the Unicorn is due out in the autumn, so you can go and listen to some more John Williams then. Time for a world premiere now, though, by Johnny Greenwood, who, as well as being the lead guitarist of Radiohead and credited with writing most of the band's material, is also the BBC Concert Orchestra's composer in residence. His work with the orchestra has spawned two film scores. A work called Popcorn Superhet Receiver became the film score to the Daniel Day-Lewis film, There Will Be Blood, and won the Evening Standard Best Film Score Award. The orchestra then asked him to write a piece called Doghouse, which was subsequently used in the Japanese film Norwegian Wood, which was released last year. Now, Robert Ziegler then went off and rearranged it as an orchestral suite, and it is that we're going to hear for the first time tonight. Johnny Greenwood's in the audience. I had a quick chat with him earlier. He says he can't wait to hear the piece come alive. He says there's nothing quite like hearing an orchestra start to play in a quiet room. Better than any recording, he said. When talking about this piece, he said he's fascinated by the process of hearing the music come off the paper. He's a string player. It's an interesting process, writing for the brass section, he said. But here comes Keith Lockhart once again to conduct Johnny Greenwood's Norwegian Wood Suite, the world premiere, arranged by Robert Ziegler.
Thank you. Johnny Greenwood's Norwegian Wood. The soloist there, leader of the orchestra, Cynthia Fleming, principal viola, Timothy Welsh, principal cello, Benjamin Hughes, conductor, Keith Lockhart. Johnny Greenwood's next film score will be in cinemas next month. He's written the music for the wildly anticipated There's Something About Kevin, starring Tilda Swinton. It's a bleak story, and what with that and There Will Be Blood, he did say to me earlier, romantic comedies just don't seem to be coming my way. Next, we're going to hear something from one of Britain's most prolific, diverse and well-loved composers, Richard Rodney Bennett. 75 this year and able to turn his hand to almost any genre of music, it comes as no surprise to see his name on the credits for a huge variety of films. Now, Murder on the Orient Express in 1974 was the first in an apparently inexhaustible run of all-star Agatha Christie murder mysteries, which would be, well, certainly in my memory, a staple of Christmas TV for decades. After that, we're going to hear from another giant of film music, John Barry, the man who brought us so many James Bond themes and who sadly died earlier this year. We'll hear his wonderful love theme from Out of Africa, guaranteed to make the hardest of hearts melt. And then for a rousing finish, we will be on Her Majesty's Secret Service. But first, the Agatha Christie, Murder on the Orient Express. You know, despite the combined firepower of Ingrid Bergman and Anthony Perkins, Lauren Bacall, and Albert Finney's outrageous Belgian accent playing Hercule Poirot, most people agree the real stars were The Steam Train and Richard Rodney Bennett's music. He won an Oscar nomination for the score, and we're going to hear the overture, waltz, and finale now. sight of thousands of prommers swaying gently to the overture, waltz and finale from Murder on the Orient Express by Richard Rodney Bennett, enjoying themselves almost as much as the BBC Concert Orchestra and their conductor, Keith Lockhart. Pianist Jim Osborne and oboist Lindy Harris being singled out by Keith Lockhart for special mention. Now, the first of our pieces from John Barry. The love theme from Out of Africa, the film starring Meryl Streep and Robert Redford by John Barry. A very different mood coming up, though, because we're going to hear a medley of Bond themes by John Barry with additional material by David.
Thank you.
They love that here in the Royal Albert Hall. A medley of Bond themes, just some of the famous tunes from the 11 Bond films that John Barry scored. Shouts and whistles here for the BBC Concert Orchestra and Keith Lockhart, and a special round of applause for guitarist as well, Ian Laws. That famous solo in the Bond theme at the end there. There was music as well from current Bond composer David Arnold making an appearance too. I hope you spotted all the films. I certainly got On Her Majesty's Secret Service, Moonraker, I think I got Quantum of Solace, and I think we all got Goldfinger. John Barry, much missed composer of so many wonderful scores, of course not just James Bond, but Zulu and the Ipcress File, Dances with Wolves, Born Free, and the wonderful Out of Africa love theme that we heard a little earlier. Keith Lockhart coming back onto the stage now to take more applause. The BBC Concert Orchestra play this kind of music so well, don't they? Such a fun evening we've all had here. And I think we might just get something of an encore. I've got that feeling. Keith Lockhart just holding up his finger saying, shall we have one more? And the Ugly, the main theme there by Ennio Morricone, with added special effects from the percussion section. And if you like that, stick around, because you must tune in at 10:15 for the Spaghetti Western Orchestra. Lots more by Ennio Morricone, but as you've never heard it before. Tomorrow, do join BBC Radio 3 for the first ever comedy prom, starring Tim Minchin and Sue Perkins, Kid and the Widow, Susan Bullock, the great soprano, many more stars appearing there. Again, something of a first. That's live here on Radio 3. It'll be on BBC 2 in a couple of weeks' time. With the concert orchestra once again. They've got a busy weekend. Keith Lockhart giving his all as he comes back on stage. You know, the joy of watching this orchestra is also seeing Keith Lockhart dancing on the podium as he's conducting. But as the cheers continue to ring around the Royal Albert Hall tonight, it is now time for me to hand you back to Broadcasting House and John Shea.
Thank you, Katie Derham. And as ever, you can hear this concert again online for the next 7 days. And as Katie mentioned, it is fun to watch these proms, and tonight's concert has been televised by our colleagues over on BBC Four, so you may like to use the BBC iPlayer to help you relive tonight's fun by watching the concert as well as listening to it. If you start at the Radio 3 homepage, you'll find your way to the iPlayer and all should become clear from there. Well, as Katie told us, we're back at the Royal Albert Hall for the second part of tonight's double bill of film music in about an hour from now. There's quite a big scene change called for between tonight's two concerts, and what's more, it all has to be done without resorting to CGI. So we hope to be ready to ride into town with the Spaghetti Western Orchestra at about 10:15, or pretty soon after that. But before that, there's a chance to hear the winning entries in this year's Proms Inspire Young Composers Competition. They'll be introduced by Andrew McGregor in a little over 10 minutes from now at 9:30. And speaking of competitions, you may know that this year we've been holding our first ever Proms Poetry Competition, offering you a chance to hear a poem written by you performed in front of an audience as part of Proms Plus, and then broadcast on Radio 3. All you have to do is send in a poem inspired by one piece of music in this year's Proms season. And we've extended the deadline now for the competition because some of you have been having technical problems with downloading the application form, and there's also been some conflicting information about age categories. So, if you'd like to enter the Proms Poetry Competition, all you have to do is go to the BBC Proms website, follow the links to Ian McMillan's Proms Poetry page, and there you'll find that applications are welcome until the extended closing date of this coming Monday, that's the 15th of August. You'll also find details there of how to apply, including the fact that there are three age categories, 7 to 11, 12 to 18 and over 18. And of course, the competition's terms and conditions are there as well, all at bbc.co.uk/proms.
Four Saturday afternoon concerts from the BBC Proms. On BBC Radio 3, the Proms Saturday matinee concerts bring together the music of Richard Rodney Bennett, Harrison Birtwistle, Hildegard of Bingen and Sofia Gubaidulina in the spectacular acoustic of London's Cadogan Hall. Hear every note here on BBC Radio 3 and join me, Christopher Cook, for the first of the four tomorrow afternoon from 3 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
And Christopher mentioning Richard Rodney Bennett's name reminds me to tell you that if you missed last Monday evening's broadcast of Richard Rodney Bennett in conversation with Norman Lebrecht, well, you've still got a couple of days to catch up with that, again, via the Radio 3 homepage. So, before Proms Inspire at 9:30, some piano music by a composer who's no stranger to writing for the cinema, Philip Glass. This, though, is the finale from his opera Satyagraha, arranged for piano. Bruce Brubaker is the pianist. Bruce Brubaker played the finale from Philip Glass's opera Satyagraha.
The question is not what you look at, but what you see.
The camera was no longer an instrument that recorded presences. It was a way of making the world disappear.
I know I change, have changed. But whose is this vapid face, suspended in empty paper, as though in a telescope?
From Auden Atwood and Oster to Leos Janacek and Charles Ives. On BBC Radio 3, music, poetry and prose inspired by centuries of photographs and photography, with Robert Powell and Geraldine James. The Photograph.
On the screen, we can only witness human behaviour. Choice is for camera crews.
An uninterrupted sequence of words and music. Sunday night at 10:15 on BBC Radio 3.
And before that, on Sunday evening, another chance to hear Zainab Badawi's report from Khartoum last year on the efforts of Sudan's creative artists to help bring peace to a country which had suffered violent internal conflict. Theatre, dance and song all played their part in preparing the country for a future which would be decided by the 2010 referendum, one which, as we now know, would lead to the creation of two separate countries. Theatre at the Frontline, that's our feature on Sunday evening at 9:30. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 9:30 now, and time for Proms Inspire, recorded last Saturday at the Royal College of Music in London. Here's Andrew McGregor.
What is Proms Inspire? Well, it's an environment in which budding young composers can share ideas, they can try new stuff, they can work with professional musicians, and of course meet other composers. And it comes to a climax in a day of workshops and a winner's concert here at the Royal College of Music. Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet is in the second half of the prom this evening, given by the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain, and the influence of that work has been felt throughout the workshops here in the college, as I'm sure we'll be hearing. Now, across the year, there have been composer labs in five cities around the UK, and hundreds of 12 to 18-year-olds have been sending in their compositions since January this year, and the judging panel's been choosing the best of them. We're going to hear the three winning pieces performed by musicians from the Aurora Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Collin. And I'm hoping to catch up with all the winners and find out more about their pieces. And we'll also be dropping in on the composition, improvisation and electronic workshops that have been buzzing with activity all day.
All right, now we're going to have the chorus. All right, here we go at H. Yeah, but no, look at clusters, not chords. You know, nice, tight cluster. Okay, here we go.
Now, we've just moved across to the Britain Theatre at the Royal College of Music, where they have a contemporary composition workshop at the moment, which is being run by Stephen Montague in the theatre. Now, Stephen, I suppose one of the most interesting things for you is that you never quite know who's going to come along and what sort of material you're going to have to work with in terms of the players.
Indeed, that is. It's quite terrifying, you know, when you try to put together something that will fit with, if you have 20 flutes and one oboe, or no flutes and no oboes, no clarinets. So it's an open score kind of skeletal piece in which a large part of it is their input into the compositional issues that are facing them in this piece.
So there's a lot of freedom for the players. You can see from the score, there's lots of blanks and X's and wiggly lines, so there's lots of freedom for improvisation.
Sure, and it's to try to get something that has an interesting shape, that has some forward drive, but doesn't enslave them in notes that they may or may not be able to play. So we have sort of grade 2 players, a couple of people that don't read music, and grade 8 players, and so it's a wide variety, which is always a challenge for every composer to write something that has the full spectrum of possibilities.
And you'll have got quite a few players that won't have done anything like this before. This, I think, most, do you feel the sort of newness of it as it sort of creeps up on them, exactly what they have to do?
Well, I did a little chart as to what an arrowhead means, play any high note or any low note. And yes, most of them have not encountered this. So, one of the questions this morning was, which any high note? I said, it doesn't matter. So, well, a B flat? I said, that's fine. How about if I played an A? Of course, you know. And this concept is so alien that any high note actually is any high note, folks.
And Stephen, I couldn't help noticing that there was a certain amount of Prokofiev in there. Obviously, Romeo and Juliet's a bit of a starting point for it.
The piece is based on the Prokofiev. So the opening passage that I have put into this score is from the Montagues and Capulets in the beginning of Suite 2. And I've taken that as a kind of a launch pad for having other gestures that are Prokofiev-like and some of the rhythms and so forth. So it's easily identified as something that is akin to the Romeo and Juliet that they will hear this evening at the prom.
My name is Buki Bayode and I play the flute. I just finished my grade 5 like a couple of months ago. I live in southwest London in Stockwell.
Have you ever done anything like this before? Is this the first time for you?
Yeah, the first time. I've never done anything like this.
Tell me something about the piece you've been rehearsing.
It's called Where's Juliet? It's nice, but it's very peculiar because the conductor asks us to play like random notes at sometimes. And like usually in an orchestra, the instrumental people wouldn't really be using their voices, but we're saying stuff like shh, we're making noises as well.
So you're getting involved in the process of creating the piece, yeah, in a way you wouldn't normally,
yeah,
in the orchestra.
It's quite a free piece.
Yeah,
so we got to add stuff to it.
And what's been the most interesting thing about the whole experience?
Playing different things. I don't really like play stuff like this. And it's quite fun just experimenting with other people. Yeah, it's really nice. It's really good.
The first piece we're going to hear from the Proms Inspire Young Composers Concert won the junior competition. It's by George Rimmer from Manchester. George, how old are you?
I am 17 at the moment, but when I wrote the piece, I was 16.
Right, and the title, I think I know this.
Arkansas Chug-a-Bug 8.
It's Wacky Races, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Wacky Races.
So it's that classic kids cartoon, the Hanna-Barbera one.
Yeah, I've always loved it. So, it's been one of my favourite cartoons as I've been growing up. And I thought, well, it would be cool to write some music about the things that I like. And it is one of them, so.
And did it actually start with the cartoon itself? Was that the direct inspiration?
No, the first inspiration was more of like the textual things of the piece. I saw a collage by the artist Barry Reigate, RSVP, in the Saatchi Gallery. And I kind of linked together the cartoonist style, the collage he's got, with the cartoon that I like, and then tried to extrapolate this and make it a musical idea. So it's not supposed to be programmatically about the car, it just is based around the car.
But if you know Wacky Races and you've seen the Arkansas Chug-a-Bug 8, what should we listen out for? How have you actually sort of written that into the music?
Well, there's a big section in the middle where it breaks down. After the huge big crash, they've got all synchronized chords together, all playing at once, and it all just stops. And it's like the engine's trying to start again with this kind of and it doesn't quite make it till it kicks into action and starts again. I've used like this idea of car horns as well later on, where you have the oboe playing yada, yada, and it just gets faster and faster as if a car in the distance is catching up on them. I noticed this after writing the piece. It wasn't actually intentional that it sounded like this, but it came out like that.
What's it been like having it performed by the Aurora Orchestra?
Oh, it's fantastic. I couldn't have asked for anything better. It was absolutely amazing. Wonderful experience.
Good day.
More than a good day. A lot more than a good day. It's fantastic. Best day of my life so far.
Thank you. Arkansas Chuggabug 8 by George Rimmer, inspired by a collage of cartoon imagery, including the legendary Wacky Races. And George was the junior winner of the BBC Inspire Young Composers Competition. I've just been listening to an improvisation workshop, or the results of an improvisation workshop, and I'm joined by James. And James, what were you actually playing in this?
We were doing lots of improvisation, and we were using an excerpt of a score, and we were playing bits of that and with improvisations in between.
And how did it actually start? Because I'm always interested, when somebody says an improvisation workshop, I mean, everybody comes in, you've not met each other before, a lot of you. You're all playing different instruments at different levels. Yes. How do you all actually begin the workshop?
Well, first of all, he talks to you about what we're going to be doing, sort of improvisation and the looking at the different scores. Then he sets up a drum and bass riff, and then he adds on different instruments, doing different things. And then he cuts off certain instruments, puts some back until he comes up with a good combination. And then he can keep that and put it in at any time he wants.
So you're sort of working out blocks of sound that you can all drop in whenever you get the signal from Peter. Have you ever done anything like this before?
No, it's completely new to me. I'm usually playing stuff written down on a score, and it's completely new. It's nothing unlike anything ever.
Have you enjoyed it? Would you do it again?
Yes, definitely. It's great fun, yeah. Being able to create different sounds that you would never normally be allowed to play. Like using the stand for your instrument, hitting against it, and using it as a mute.
So Peter Weigold, you were in charge of everything. How do you actually run an improvisation workshop like this?
What I always say is you have to get, like in jazz, you have to get the bass and drums tight before you put saxophone solos on. So the most important thing is to do really simple things at the beginning, like getting rhythms together, getting people cross rhythms, heard as cross rhythms. So you've got to get the band clicking, or even just a high trilly avant-garde texture. But you've got to get all the ears in so they all know their part in a certain texture or sound. And then you've got a kind of virtuous situation where they've all heard it work and then it kind of grows on it. So you have to ground it to start with.
And you've got one or two sort of seasoned pros to get things started off.
Yeah, I've got my own ensemble, Noti Nigal, three of them. So they can do a great bass line or a great guitar riff, and that certainly helps.
So you've got your foundation, but then you've also got this bunch of children of various ages who coming in with all kinds of instruments, all kinds of experience, completely different kinds of enthusiasms.
Yeah.
Do you ever have any idea what's going to happen?
No. Well, only in the broadest terms, like I will start with ground and then follow what comes. But, you know, there was a viola player there who was great, who looked at me at one point, and that meant he wanted to do something. And in the middle of a very tonal bit, he did a scratchy noise, and it was brilliant. So then we all went scratchy. So I wasn't expecting a viola to make a scratchy noise in the middle of a very tonal bit. So my job really is to spot people who are ready to do something and then follow them or work with them when they do it.
It's time to meet our second winner now. This is 17-year-old Hannah Dilts. She's one of the two winners of the senior category. And Hannah, it sounds as though you're already a pretty experienced composer. You've had pieces performed in quite a number of circumstances. The Smith Quartet, you have something played in Berlin by a saxophone quartet. How long have you been doing this?
Literally only since the beginning of college. It was due to all the opportunities I've had with my college and my music department there, so I must thank them, obviously, that we've had the chance to write for all these fabulous like groups and things. It's just been amazing.
Now, I can't think offhand of another piece inspired by Spike Milligan. Tell us about your two nonsenses.
To begin with, it was just a little bit of an exercise, and we had an ensemble going at college called the Composers Ensemble. And I was like, oh, I could just write a piece for that. Let's see what happens. And I thought, well, I'd been having a couple of composition lessons and we'd been looking at Walton's Facade. And I thought, why don't I write a piece like that, but a little bit more wacky, suited to Spike Milligan's poetry. And it's all a bit mental, which is reflected in both the words and in the music, I think. And it's just wonderful to hear it played like that.
Well, I know Ning Nang Nong, Where the Cows Go Bong, and that's a great sort of noise opportunity. But what's Bongaloo?
Bongaloo is even more nonsensical than Ning Nang Long. It's just this. It's like a father and son relationship where this boy asks his dad, "What is a bongaloo, Daddy?" And the father replies, "A bongaloo, son," said I, "is a tall bag of cheese plus a Chinaman's knees and a leg of a nanny goat's eye." And you're just a bit like looking at those words. You're like, okay, he's completely off his rocker. What's he gonna say next? And I was just like, I just wanted to reflect it as much as possible in the music. And so, of course, I've got really comical bits, like in the trombone, glissandos all over the place. And then I've got other instruments doing things which aren't really suited to them. Like I've got oboes playing things that saxophone should be playing.
Said I, it's a tall bag of cheese plus a Chinaman's knees and the leg of a nanny goat's eye. Not explain. It's tall around the nose, which continually grows in the general direction of Spain. Are you sure there's a bongaloo, Daddy? Am I sure, my son? Said I. Why, I've seen it not quite on a dark, sunny night. Do you think that I'd tell you a lie? Jabba Joo. On the Ning Nang Nang, all the mice go clang, and you just can't catch them when they do. So it's Ning Nang Nong, cows go bong, nong, nang, nang.
Two Nonsenses by Hannah Dilks, Spike Milligan's nonsense poetry, given a whole new context by one of the senior winners of the Proms Inspire competition. Well, backstage here at the Royal College of Music, I'm with Anna Meredith, not that ancient a composer herself, I have to say. Anna, you're one of the judges on the judging panel for this competition process. You've been working today with the National Youth Orchestra's Creative Hub. Now, you better explain to us exactly what it is, first of all. How does it work?
So the Creative Hub is our name for the composition, the creative aspect of the National Youth Orchestra, which runs alongside the main orchestral course. So myself and my colleague Larry Goves both have been going to courses in the winter and spring and summer where six young composers have been working and rehearsing and trying and experimenting alongside the main orchestra, and we've been looking at all sorts of different compositional things. So for the players, this has been, I suppose, our final performance of our show, which is the deleted scenes from Romeo and Juliet, where we've been, our brief to the composers was to write a very short piece about an idea from the original Shakespeare that Prokofiev didn't do.
So what kind of deleted scenes were the composers coming up with? That sounds pretty interesting.
For example, one of our composers, Ben Weatherfield, has written these pieces about a very minor character, Benvolio, who is quite often taunted by Mercutio for getting into fights, which Ben found a bit weird because in the play he actually seems like a bit of a pacifist. So Ben had this idea that maybe in a past life Benvolio had been a bit of a rude boy who'd like to stir up lots of trouble. So he's written five little miniatures, five quarrels, which just imagine these fights that Benvolio might have got into.
Back to the Proms Inspire competition winners concert. The other winner in the senior category is Jack Sheen. Now, Jack, I gather you're about to take the plunge and become a full-time composition student?
Yeah, full-time composition student at the Royal Northern College of Music. I'm going to be studying on the joint course, hopefully, if I get the grades.
And you've already been a composer for the National Youth Orchestra.
Yeah, it's been brilliant. It's been really, really inspiring to be able to work with the players. That's definitely been the most rewarding thing that I've.
And it's a pretty big orchestra to have at your disposal as well.
Yeah, there was one day where we had 10 minutes each for the with the full orchestra, which is 175 of them, so that was mind-blowing. Yeah.
Well, your winning piece is called Aviaries. So was the starting point the birds, or did avian ideas come into it later on?
No, it's the complete opposite, actually. It was titled after after it was finished. And I just thought the title suited the music quite well. There's lots of safe, self-contained little almost chambers of quite cacophonous movement, and I thought that suited the image of lots of birds taking off and creating a sort of a visual cacophony themselves.
So no point listening for birdsong?
Definitely no birdsong in that. It's much more sort of a visual in a way.
And what was the actual starting point for the piece? There's a lot of sort of ethereal harmonics and things
like
that in it as well.
100%. Well, it was originally a one movement quartet which was going to be workshopped, so I had a lot of license to really experiment and kind of go wild, and that's definitely the route that I wanted to go down. Textually, so I just sort of took that to its logical conclusion. It's quite extreme, and I would say about 98% of that is harmonics, and that was something which was really, really encouraged. So I was really encouraged to do by the quartet workshop that they said, you know, it's really, really exciting when we get these sort of pieces, but we just want more and more and more, just take it to real extremes, and that's what I did. Thank you.
aviaries, the sound of birds taking flight in the string quartet by Jack Sheen, played by members of the Aurora Orchestra. And that's the other piece that won in the senior section of the Proms Inspire Composition Competition. Well, if I'm slightly out of breath, it's because we've just sprinted up to the very top of the Royal College of Music. We're under the eaves here, with the roof timbers above us, and surrounded by laptops, electronics, computers, mixing desks, and it's the 21cc workshop. Now, exactly what's been going on?
My name's Max. What looks like the very best music mixing technology money can buy. You know, everything you sort of need to get loads of musicians in one place at one time and make a good bit of electronic music. So we've got laptops, we've got pads to play musical samples. What we've been doing is we've been taking samples from various musical sources and using sort of a song from Romeo and Juliet as a baseline. We've been making what's called a Romeo and Juliet mashup, in which we just take lots of the samples from different sources and we play them and sequence them to make an overall really big song.
I'm Zach and I'm here with the 21cc as well.
Now, have you done this kind of thing before? Are you an old hand at using some of this kind of equipment and manipulating samples?
I just finished my A-level in music technology and I'm planning to do a degree in composition and
so
technology.
You're right at home here, but what have you must have been working with a lot of people who actually haven't experienced this kind of thing before. You've got a real mixture of people.
Yeah, it's quite nice to see people's fresh new ideas on stuff that I'm already comfortable with, to see their take on it and how they use it creatively.
Is it making you think differently about the music sometimes?
Yeah, definitely.
As well?
Yeah.
And what sort of instruction set did you have when you sat down? Because you've only got, 40 minutes to create something, haven't you?
No. Well, I was quite comfortable with software called Cubase, which is similar to the software I'm using today. So it's just sort of finding my feet, really.
And elements of live performance involved as well. So you're actually using some of the young musicians we've got here on their own instruments.
Yeah, we used these pads with the different buttons on, which trigger different sounds. So we were all sort of making our own sounds using that, per se. And we also had live instruments that were mic'd up as well.
And how would you describe the piece you ended up with?
It was an electronic sort of remix of Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet. I think if he were alive today, pretty similar to what he would have imagined it to sound like.
Some of the sounds of one of the best equipped electronic toy shops I think I've ever seen. That's the BBC's 21st Century Classroom, 21cc, put through its paces by the Proms Inspire Days young composers, who've spent the day exploring and experimenting in all kinds of new ways, as we've been hearing. Our very best wishes to all of them for the future. And as well as the competition winners we've already played you, the Inspire Days concert included the highly commended runners-up. If you keep your ears open, you may hear some of them around the prom broadcasts on Radio 3. And as a taster, we thought we'd end our Proms Inspire Day with a collage of our own.